Well, good morning. I'm Dina. I'm one of you. I'm not one of the pastors on staff, so it's quite an honor and a privilege to speak to you this morning. I want to start out by telling you a story from my own childhood. I attended Ingleside Middle School in Phoenix, Arizona. That's coming. In seventh and eighth grade, my twin sister and I would take the bus 3 miles to and from Ingleside Middle School. On some days, however, we did not take the bus, we walked. We walked because at some point during the day, two boys would get into a tussle, and because you're not allowed to get in a full-fledged fight at school, one would growl at the other, "Prince of Peace," after school. There's Prince of Peace. Prince of Peace was the Lutheran church a couple blocks from Ingleside. It was on 56th Street, which divided two major neighborhoods of kids, the two tribes of kids that flooded into Ingleside Middle School. The irony of Prince of Peace as the setting for school fights was totally lost on us. But looking back, I'm aware that because these boys were in the thick of developing their strong egos, they couldn't help it but want to stake their claim, to be in the in-group, to develop a good identity. And so even though it was the 1970s and America, and most of these kids probably went to church and worshiped, at least in word, if not in spirit, the Prince of Peace, they chose the Prince of Peace parking lot to beat the snot out of each other. Our passage today is no less ironic in its setting versus its message. For Paul, prison, suffering, and the prospect of death are the context for a letter filled with joy and freedom from ego and the present experience of Christ now and the hope of being with Christ in death. So as we begin, would you join me in a word of prayer? God, we come to you now, continuing in worship as we look into your word. And I pray that you would be present with us, and that the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart would be acceptable unto you, O God. Amen. So here are the words of Paul to the church in Philippi. This is chapter 1, verses 12 through 26. He writes, "Now I want you to know, brothers and sisters, that what has happened to me has actually served to advance the gospel. As a result, it has become clear throughout the whole palace guard and to everyone else that I am in chains for Christ. And because of my chains, most of the brothers and sisters have become confident in the Lord and dare all the more to proclaim the gospel without fear. It is true that some preach Christ out of envy and rivalry, but others out of goodwill. The latter do so out of love, knowing that I am put here for the defense of the gospel. The former preach Christ out of selfish ambition, not sincerely, supposing that they can stir up trouble for me while I am in chains. But what does it matter? The important thing is that in every way, whether from false motives or true, Christ is preached. And because of this, I rejoice. Yes, and I will continue to rejoice, for I know that through your prayers and God's provision of the Spirit of Jesus Christ, what has happened to me will turn out for my deliverance. I eagerly expect and hope that I will in no way be ashamed, but will have sufficient courage so that now, as always, Christ will be exalted in my body, whether by life or by death. For to me, to live is Christ, and to die is gain. If I am to go on living in the body, this will mean fruitful labor for me. Yet what shall I choose? I do not know. I am torn between the two. I desire to depart to be with Christ, which is better by far, but is far more necessary for you that I remain in the body. Convinced of this, I know that I will remain, and I will continue with all of you for your progress and joy in the faith, so that through my being with you again, your boasting in Christ Jesus will abound on account of me." The word of the Lord. So before we dive into this text, let's just take a little bit of a wide angle look at the context where Paul is writing from and what he's writing about. This letter to Philippians is probably Paul's most joyful letter. The word joy or rejoice appears 16 times. And it's not written primarily for instruction or like some of his letters where there's a lot of kind of correction or even rebuke. But really, it's a thank you letter. It's a thank you letter to his friends. Most scholars believe that Timothy and Paul were imprisoned together in Ephesus. And here's what a prison in Ephesus was like. It was typically overcrowded, it was dark, there was little natural light. The prisoners' feet were chained to a wall and then chained to a guard. So that was not a metaphor that he is in chains. And then, most importantly, they're not given any food or medicine from the prison. Families and friends of the prisoners have to bring that to him. So Paul is really thanking the Philippians for sending this money, maybe even medicine, and probably the parchment he's writing on, to the prison in Ephesus. So how does Paul get here? How does Paul, not how did he get in prison, but how does he get to this attitude of joy, of courage in prison? So I want to ask and try to explore these questions. How does he rejoice that the gospel is being preached by his competitors? How does he face possible execution and proclaim that he'd actually rather die, but he knows that he needs to stay and be there for the Philippians? I'd like to suggest that Paul could be this unburdened by his ego, this free to share the gospel, and this open to heaven or more life on earth because he has journeyed through liminal space. So here's where we need to do a little definition. What is liminal space? It's something we've all experienced and we know when we're there. So Richard Rohr says that, first of all, it comes from the Latin word limens, which means a threshold. A liminal space is the space of transition, waiting, and not knowing. It's a unique spiritual position where human beings hate to be, but where the biblical God is always leading them. It's when you are between your old comfort zone and any new possible answer. It's the place that makes transitions possible. So think of C.S. Lewis's wardrobe. It's that space between England and Narnia. It's that place where Lucy enters in and she feels fur coats because she's hiding, and all of a sudden the fur coats turn to branches. And she's disoriented, but she's able to move into this new world and this new awareness. I think sometimes liminal space happens most obviously in the birth of a child, when we're no longer the center of our own universe and somebody else is, or when we lose a job, or when a loved one dies, or during an illness or disability. During this grace time, we're not certain or in control, and we're not even sure of who we are anymore, but we are becoming more like Christ. So here's what I'm going to unpack about liminal space in light of Paul. It's mystical. It allows us to move beyond our own egos, our own identities that we present to the world in the context of a loving community. Liminal space invites us to wrestle with our fears and our worries, and liminal space happens in times of suffering. So first, Paul is a mystic, so we know that somehow this liminal space is mystical. Do you remember his conversion story in Acts chapter 9? If you don't, I'll just give you a little synopsis. So Paul is called Saul at this point, and he is a zealous Jewish person trying to put all the followers of Christ in prison because they're disrupting the Jewish faith. And as he's journeying from Jerusalem to Damascus, all of a sudden there's this light, this blinding light, and Jesus is there and says, "Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me?" And he says, "Who are you?" And he's blinded. Literally, his old way of seeing the world is taken away from him. And his friends take him back to a house in Damascus, and he's just sitting there by himself in his blindness, not eating or drinking for 3 whole days. And then poor Ananias, this reluctant disciple, gets news that he is the one who has to go to Saul and heal him of his blindness. This is the first liminal experience for Paul. It's something he doesn't choose. It's just, boom, in his face. So for Paul, that's why in Ephesians and Galatians, he's so hard on these people who are making rules for the Christians, that the men need elective surgery and everybody else has to follow all these rules. He has this bedrock experience of Christ that allows him to say, for me to live is Christ and to die is gain. And I think this is why he can let go of his precious ego. I think it's what Jesus means when he says to his followers that they need to deny themselves. In our passage, and I really had never noticed this before, I was just dumbfounded by Paul's lack of ego. Isn't it striking in verse 18 that he says, but what does it matter? The important thing is that in every way, whether from false motives or true, Christ is preached, and because of that, I rejoice. He goes so far in rejoicing that others are competing with him and making life harder for him, but that results in preaching the gospel. He doesn't defend himself. I mean, if I were writing this letter, I'd be like, who do you like better, me or those other guys who are preaching? There's no hint of that adolescent Prince of Peace after school. He reminds them that they are his joy. He can be so free of his ego because he has Timothy there in prison with him. He has the concern of the Philippians sending him money, sending him medicine. It's his startling disregard for his ego and leaning on the love and support of his community that results in this tremendous freedom to stay on task, to keep preaching the good news of God's grace. So I think it's this mystical experience on the road to Damascus and this liminal experience in jail that results in this lack of fear when he's confronted with his mortality. You know, interestingly, we sometimes are, at least I am, concerned about what makes us happy, and especially when we get to the end of our life. And there's a guy from Cornell University, a professor. His name's Carl Pillemer. He and his team did this study, and they asked 1,200 elders, which are people 65 and older, what do you regret when you look back on your life? In this service, there's not as many people 65 or older, but in the first service, they were all, like, thinking about it. And you know what? Carl Pillemer expected these big-ticket items that people would say. He thought they'd say an affair, a shady business deal, addictions. But do you know what the answer that they most often gave was? I wish I hadn't spent so much of my life worrying. I wish I hadn't been so fearful. He writes, what the elders tell us is consistent with our findings. The key characteristic of worry, according to scientists, is that it takes place in the absence of actual things to worry about. It's this kind of ruminating worry about the possible bad things that might happen to us, and it saps our energy for actually living. And here Paul has something very real to worry about, his own possible execution, and yet he rejoices. He keeps proclaiming the good news. He sounds very unworried. And actually, Greek scholars say he's not worried, he's not fearful, but he is wrestling. I don't know if you noticed as we read that the passage, at the end, it's like he's processing as he's writing. He's like, I don't know what would be better, if I should be with Christ or if I should stay here. And the Greek scholars say that the syntax is really wonky. It's not how Paul usually wrote. It's like he has this internal struggle, that prison is a liminal space for working out. Does he want life here or life in heaven? And really, he's not in control. I confess, maybe like some of you, that I am a worrier. I'll never forget gathering for a heart-to-heart, which is a women's Bible study, a few days after 9/11. Do you guys remember that day? So the Twin Towers had come down, and although I knew vaguely that there was such a thing as terrorism, I was so frightened. A day before our heart-to-heart Bible study, I found out that I was pregnant with my third child, Isaac. And I felt so panicky about bringing another child into this world. Our heart-to-heart small group was almost all young moms, and Christina Rossmullen. There she is. And Christina said to us, don't worry, which I thought easy for you to say. But it was easy for her to say because her life bore witness that even when there are true horrors to fear, we can trust the God who holds our lives and our deaths in his hands. Some of you knew Christina. She passed away a year ago. She grew up in Holland, and as a teenager in her little Dutch town, Nazis invaded, took all their food, imposed curfews, and her mom would boil tulip bulbs for dinner and put them to bed, put the kids to bed at 4 p.m. so they wouldn't be hungry. And then later, when she came to this country and lived here, she was a volunteer chaplain at the jail. I remember she told us that when the jail chaplain asked her if she would volunteer, she said simply, "I don't like criminals." And here's where Christina had a choice. She had a choice to cross over a threshold from where she felt comfortable, from where she was secure in her beliefs of what criminals were like and what they deserved and how she didn't need to be hanging out with them, into a new, more gracious and loving and Christ-like way of being. So of course, she ended up being a volunteer chaplain. She entered that liminal space. She saw the image of God in people in jail. And she told us that her view was literally shaken. It's like the branch, the coats becoming branches where you're disoriented. And she has this new way of seeing criminals as image bearers. Wouldn't it be nice if liminal space, these doorways of transformation, these new ways of living with less ego and less worry were just simple little thresholds that we could step over. But the hard and sometimes beautiful reality is that liminal space is most often born out of suffering. For Paul, it happens in Damascus on the road when he's blind. It happened in prison. He'd been a big shot in the Jewish community, and he says at the end of Philippians, that his credentials, his good deeds, his pedigree of race are all garbage. I'm pretty sure that none of us go in search of suffering. We'll do anything to avoid it. But the suffering that comes from just being a Christ follower, just being a human in the world, is why Paul ends the first chapter saying, there's more, far more to this life than trusting in Christ. There's also suffering for him. And the suffering is as much a gift as the trusting. I remember a poignant time of suffering in my own life when my ego had been kicked to the curb and I sat in the office of a wise counselor for the first but not last time in my life. And I told her my sob story. And do you know what she didn't say? She didn't say, "Oh, you poor dear," and pick my side and be in the parking lot of Prince of Peace. And she didn't try to cheer me up and say, "At least you have three beautiful children." What she said, with the hint of a smile, like she knew something I didn't, was, "It's perfect timing," which made me want to kick her in the shins and also give her a hug for throwing me a life raft. Why was it perfect timing? So there's the obvious, I was 39 years old and ripe for a midlife crisis, but I don't think that's what she meant. I think she meant it's perfect timing to enter liminal space whenever we have those times of suffering. It's a perfect time for me to let go of identities that had propped up my ego for several decades. Theological student, pastor's wife, obedient Christian, safety first worry wart, which I'm still trying to drop. It was a perfect time to be disoriented, to be anonymous, to go deeper into living out my faith from a hidden place. And during this time, there was a line from an ancient poem that just was emblazoned on my head and my heart. And my friends, if you're here, you've heard it a million times. It goes, "Don't turn away, keep your eye on the bandaged place. That's where the light enters in." When I meet new people and they learn that I'm a hospice chaplain, they often say the same thing. They say, you might say this, "Oh, I could never do that. That would be so sad." And it is sad when people die, and I do not want to minimize that in any way. And I am exquisitely aware today as I look out and see many of you and know your losses. and it is sad. And I sometimes wonder if Paul could say that to die is Christ and to live is Christ and to die is gain, because he was single, because he didn't have a wife and kids. And really, only a few times over the past 6 years have I ever heard a hospice patient quote Paul and say that to live is Christ and die is gain. But when people die well, especially when they're very old, and I haven't known them personally ahead of time, and they're full of faith and they're not clinging to their egos, it is so beautiful. These dying people are beautiful when they admit that, yes, maybe they had wasted some of their life worrying rather than trusting in goodness and grace, but they are trusting God's grace now as they let go of this life. And these dying people are beautiful when at the end of their life, all they have energy for is gratitude for the people who have loved them through their times of suffering. It's when I'm sitting with hospice patients and they're like those adolescents in the Prince of Peace parking lot, and they are still saying, it's those people's fault that this happened to me, or telling me all about the wrong that has happened to them when they haven't been able to look in and see their shadows and wounds. Those people become cautionary tales, living quite the opposite of Paul in prison. So I ask myself, don't we, of all people, want to live with open hearts towards God and our neighbor, to proclaim Jesus' message of grace, to live with less fear, knowing that we are children of God? So it's true, we can't manufacture liminal space. I don't think we'd want to, really. But we can respond to the invitations when we encounter it. We can daily have some practice of silence where we let go of our hamster wheel stories that we tell ourselves, and we can sit in God's grace and love. We can meditate on a verse. For me, over the past few months, I found myself in liminal space when I've become friends with somebody who is very other than me. And truth be told, it's one of those delightful liminal spaces. It's not like me suffering in jail, but it is me becoming friends with someone who has suffered. So I'll end with this story. In January, a Syrian refugee family left Jordan and came to Canada. And they ended up at this farm. There they are. They ended up at a farm just north of the border where six families live in intentional Christian community and decided to host a Syrian refugee family. And as it happens, my sister and her family, sitting right over there, are one of the families hosting them. So I have gotten the joy and privilege, as I visit my sister and her family, to get to know the Abdo family, and Ms. Gein in particular. She's the one, she's right there. She's 6 years old. She's very precocious. She's very outgoing and smart. In 6 months, she's become fluent in English. She has her mother's tenacity and her father's sense of humor and eyebrows. Last week, my sister and I took our kids and Ms. Gein and her little brother to the swimming pool. And as we were sitting in the back seat, she grabbed my arm and she said, "Dina, you're my favorite girl." Then she looked at me quizzically and asked, "How old are you?" Honestly, for a moment, I could not remember how old I was, and I am not lying here. I felt like saying, "I'm 8, because that's how carefree and happy I felt learning that I was her favorite girl, and because I was wedged in the back seat of the minivan in between two car seats. But of course, in the end, I remembered my age, and I said, "I'm 48. And she paused, and she looked me up and down, and she said, "That's okay." Later, back at my sister's house, we were having lunch with Ms. Gein's mom and the kids, and the conversation turned to the origin of our kids' names and what those names mean. And I told her that Isaac is from the Hebrew and it means laughter. That boy who was born, or that I knew that I was holding a few days after 9/11. And she told me that Ms. Gein means, "I want to tell you something." When I looked confused, like, what a weird name, she pulled out her phone and typed in Ms. Gein into Google Translate, and she said, "Good news. Ms. Gein means good news." And that's what she is in my life. She is the good news of liminal space. She is the good news that is carrying me over the threshold of worry and fear of terrorism that I have felt since 9/11 and certainly in recent attacks. She's carried me over the threshold to appreciation for the intelligence and kindness and resiliency of Syrian refugees like Ms. Gein and her family. Somehow this friendship helps me see more clearly the image of God in all of us and invites me to move from being stuck in that parking lot to being open to how I can be the hands and feet of Jesus right here, right now. I can't tell you where you might find liminal space. I have a feeling that if you went to Alan and Amy Mua's Sunday school class in the fall, that you'd find it. But maybe it will be a mystical experience like Paul on the road to Damascus. Or maybe it'll be some time of suffering or coming alongside someone who's suffered. But I can invite us all to be aware of the discomfort in our life. Be aware when we want to just hunker down, protect our ego, compete with somebody else. And be open to crossing those thresholds. So this morning we do have the opportunity to engage in liminal space. We're going to take communion, and I'd like us to consider that the bread and the cup is food for our journeys. It's food to nourish us when we're tempted to fear, when we're tempted to stay stuck, when we're tempted to compare. And it's food that reminds us that the God who gave his love on the cross is the same God who goes with us this week. Amen.